Natural Resources Finance Policy Committee to order. We have the minutes from January 15th. Representative Rarick, would you like to move the minutes? Thank you. Discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Minutes are approved. Welcome, Commissioner Kudelka, assistant or deputy, excuse me, Assistant Commissioner Kudelka. If you guys could tell us who you are and let us know what you're here about.
Will do. Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka, and I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency handling land and legislative policy. And with me today, I have a number of colleagues from the MPCA as we move through the presentation that will come up and give different parts of it. But a large part of it will be done by our CFO, Lyle Mueller. The commissioner sends his regrets. Unfortunately, he would like to be here, but he is at the Red River Basin Land and Water International Summit Conference for the next few days. He will be here at a future date. We'll have him come when the governor's budget is presented, so he will have the opportunity to talk to him also. Real quickly, we're here today to give you a quick overview of what MPCA does, our structure, our budgeting, and then what are the issues that we work on daily and the challenges we see moving forward. So I'd like to just start off real quick with our mission. As you can see, it's to protect and improve our environment and enhance public health. A lot of folks see the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and think about environmental health. However, a large part of our work is also working with ensuring public health. This mission statement guides what we do. This is what we always fall back to when we build our five-year strategic plans, our business plans that are done every 2 to 3 years, and annual individual work plans. This is our core mission. The MPCA is a little different from the Department of Natural Resources, which you heard a presentation last week on. We do have a citizens board. It was created in 1967 along with the agency. The agency was created and replaced at a number of commissions. And in statute, if you look under our board's authorities, it specifically talks about the MPA citizens board being the replacement for the Water Pollution Control Commission. It's chaired by our commissioner, and 8 other citizen members are appointed on 4-year staggered terms. So every year, 2 new board members are appointed by the commissioner and then confirmed by the Senate. However, much of the agency...
Excuse me, Commissioner Kudelka, did you say they're appointed by the commissioner?
Sorry, I misspoke. Chair and committee members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
Thank you.
Much of the agency work is not done by the board. That day-to-day work is delegated to the commissioner and program staff. However, the Citizens Board does provide a opportunity for the public to have access to decision makers on controversial and highly complex regulatory and environmental review issues. To give you an example of the work split, in 2014, 3 projects came before the board. And 2 of the previous year, and 3 years before, it was just 12. So on an average, about 6 different projects come before the citizen board. The overall universe of the agency is 3,000 permits. So as you can see, much of the work is done by the agency itself. And this was done in the early 90s, where board involvement on many of the permits were removed. At that time, there were subcommittees and rosters of permits that were approved and slate. And this was one of the improvements made to help speed along the less controversial or complex permits. I'd like to real quick highlight one of our handouts today. You'll see in front of you is our organizational chart. Our agency is a little different than others.
Excuse me, Commissioner Kudelka, if you're done with Citizens Board, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, with regards to the Citizens Board, what real authority do they have?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the agency board is the final decision-making body for the agency. So just like on issues, Any final decision made by the board is then appealable to the Court of Appeals.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, what's the area of, when people are appointed to the board, is there requirements for background and so forth? I mean, what's their area of expertise?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there in statute there are two board spots that have to have knowledge about agriculture is one position. The second position is knowledge about labor issues. The other six board members need to have a knowledge of environmental issues.
Representative Fabian,
follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know what the legislative intent was, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka. What's the definition of knowledge?
You care to answer that, Commissioner Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, there is no specific definition by the legislature put in the statute.
Follow-up, Representative
Thank
Fabian.
You, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, is there a model of this board in other agencies that has the same effect, the same decision-making capacity that this board has?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, the environmental agencies, there's a number of them. The Board of Water and Soil Resources is operated by a board, and things need to go before it. The Public Utilities Commission also making decisions on pipeline, electric transmission, and power plants. Also, energy and environmental issues are decided by a board.
Thank you. Follow-up. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, who determines which projects go before the board?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is a combination of two things. There are some automatic triggers in statute. For instance, if a variance is requested from a water quality or air quality or other standard, it's something that's automatically that goes before the Citizens Board. Otherwise, it's items that are put on the agenda by the commissioner as the chair of the board, or a board member can request an item to go before it.
Thank you.
Follow up. Commissioner Kadelka, I guess I would like to follow up to that point. So any single citizen board member on the commission can request a review of any project and require that project to be subjected to a vote of the Citizens Commission on whether or not it moves forward? Of any scope of anything that's under the purview of the MPCA?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is correct. The board decision can be. However, as you look at past practice, very few things come before the board. When we're looking at six different projects a year out of a universe of 3,000, many times what will happen is a citizen board member will get a request from someone from the public to ask for more information, and many times then the board member contacts the agency to get more background before making its decision, and many times the requests are not granted.
Thank you. And Commissioner Kadelka, I'm assuming on your website there's the Citizens Board, its current members and background and such about them and how long they serve and who's up for appointment when. Would that be true?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. Our website does have a listing of the board members and when they're up for reappointment. Also, it does have a list of previous agendas for numerous years so that you can go back and look at each of the meetings.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Kadelka, continue.
Real quick, I just want to highlight our org chart. You will not see a division labeled air, land, or water. However, we do have the assistant commissioners that each oversee those policy areas. Our divisions instead are driven by the type of services or efforts that they lead. So on a water issue, you may see many of the agencies' divisions working together on the issue and it not be siloed into one division. If you have more questions on the individual makeup of the org chart, I'm going to just move on to the next piece on our authorities and not spend too much time on the org chart. The next piece I want to talk about is the MPCA derives its authorities from the legislature and state statute, but a large amount of our work is also delegated to us by federal authorities. And these are delegated authorities to implement the Federal Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Superfund Program, and RCRA, also known as the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which deals with hazardous and solid waste. So instead of regulated parties working through EPA and Region 5 in Chicago, they work through the MPCA, its main office in St. Paul, and then offices in other parts of the state. So this includes environmental review, permitting, inspections, and enforcement. As we go about doing this, the federal government does audit the MPCA's implementation to ensure that we're carrying out the work. And many times we have agreements on the number of permits to be processed in a timeline or the number of inspections that need to be done on certain things such as our tanks program. With that, I'd like to hand it over to my colleague, please.
Thank you and welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I am Lyle Mueller. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the MPCA.
Welcome. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the first slide, there are a couple of things that I want to point your draw to your attention. One of them is the change in the general fund as a source of funding over this 8-year time frame. So you can see that in 2008 and 2009, the general fund was a more significant funding source. A significant change that occurred in 2010 was the establishment of the Clean Water Fund, and from that point forward, the work of the agency that was tied to carrying out the goals of the Clean Water Legacy Act switched over and were funded from the Clean Water Fund. Other things to take note of is the fact that a number of our funding sources have remained relatively stable over this time frame. So the Environmental Fund, the Remediation Fund, federal funds have largely all remained relatively stable. Just kind of circling back to the general fund, in 2008, general fund made up 15% of our operating budget, or overall budget rather. In fiscal year 15, general fund is now down to 3%. Taking a look at our staffing over the same time frame, a little longer time frame, you'll see the year-to-year changes. Staffing has remained relatively stable. A couple of notable additions to FTEs or staffing over this time frame, you'll see that starting in fiscal 7 and continuing in 8 and 9, the growth of FTEs related to the Clean Water Legacy Act. Also in the biennium 2008 and 9, we added a number of positions related to the mining and ethanol initiative. You'll see a step down in FTEs in 2012, which is largely related to the state government shutdown and the fact that we offered an early retirement incentive to a number of staff in that particular fiscal year.
Mr. Mueller, I'm going to cut you off there. I've got a few questions. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, just one question that I was looking at the previous chart where your general fund is down. Is that percentage or is that cash? Because I see your overall budget went up. So I'm just wondering if you have less funds from general or if that's a percentage that's less.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, As I stated, the percentage is significantly less. The percentage in 14 and 15 is 3%. So that is reflecting the overall budget. Member, our dollars, actual dollars, are significantly less as well.
Representative Green. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, again, on that chart that you're on, you indicated that the Clean Water Funds came in 2010. It's my understanding that those funds funded significantly new work. They weren't funding what had been going on in the past, that those funds went to projects that were added to increase the amount of activity, especially in monitoring and assessment. I would hate to leave people with the impression that we're supplanting
Mr. Mueller, or well, Commissioner Kudelka, you want to weigh in on that, or either one of you?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you are correct. Those are new activities above and beyond the regular, the previous activities the agency did. It is not an active supplant.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to Assistant Commissioner Kudelka on the slide on the federal authority, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, sir. Federal versus state standards, Assistant Commissioner Kudelka. In some cases, they are different. How then, when a permit is being requested or so forth, how do we apply either the state or the federal standards to the permit?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is by whichever one is more stringent. In many cases, the federal standard becomes a state standard, and the state just adopts the federal standard. And you see this in our air work. There are other cases, for instance, in water, where the federal government doesn't actually set a standard for phosphorus or some other type of pollutant, instead set up criteria and allow states to construct a standard that meets its needs. What is needed for water quality in Florida versus Minnesota is different, much like it's much different from southwest Minnesota and northeast Minnesota. So we work on our standards to meet the needs of Minnesotans and the uses of the water here.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, so then how are the standards set? Who sets the standards?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the standards are set through a rulemaking process that's led by the agency, that's in a public process that includes the Office of Administrative Hearings for oversight on the need and reasonableness, and that is also one of the roles of our board, is that if there are requests or if there is a hearing on a rule, that it does go before the board for its final decision.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Kudelka, you said that the water, the needs are different in Florida than they are in Minnesota, but you also said that the standard that's the most stringent is the one that's followed in Minnesota. If the demands are different, if the needs are different in different states, why would we necessarily go back to the more stringent standard?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we can't overrule what the federal government puts in place. And that's where we talk about the more stringent. In many cases, we just follow what the federal government says to be the standard, and that's how we move forward. In other cases, we may create a state standard where we believe that we have a unique resource or opportunity in Minnesota that needs to be protected. So a more accurate description, I apologize for the early confusion, maybe we follow federal standards where are there, and a state standard if we believe there is need for additional protection and benefit to the state.
Follow-up, Representative
Fabian. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Kudelka, then, a couple of things. How are the federal standards set?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, federal standards are also set through a rulemaking process through EPA.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what kind of conversations does the agency in the state of Minnesota have with the federal authorities with regards to standards and what they're going to be and the impact that it actually has on, say, businesses in the state of Minnesota or people?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just like the state's rulemaking process, there's an opportunity for public input. And that's where you see us weigh in multiple times, are through letters to EPA or discussions with staff to make sure that they understand how the impacts will be felt on Minnesota, on public health, the environment, and our business and economy.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to this graph briefly just so it's perfectly clear to me and everybody else, I hope. But and on that graph, and it's kind of small print, that your y-axis is dollars, right? That's what you said. But
Mr. Mueller.
Chair and member, yes, that's correct. The y-axis is dollars in millions.
Thanks.
Follow-up, Representative Purcell. Well, that was it. Well, that was okay. Representative Hansen, sorry.
That's quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kudelka. So, really, the question is whether the federal standards are the floor or the ceiling. We can choose that they could be the floor and have stronger standards to protect Minnesotans and protect our drinking water and not be bound by the same standards as Mississippi and Texas and those states. Or we could have them, they could be the ceiling where the federal requirements are the top. We couldn't go any further. And, you know, I don't know if, I mean, is that essentially the discussion we're having here?
I'm sorry, Commissioner Cadell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is correct.
Follow up. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, following up on federal standards versus state standards, it's my understanding that right now we have airborne mercury standards that are more stringent than the federal standards. Is that correct right now?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we did recently have a rulemaking on mercury. I think it's important to provide a little bit of background. The state here a number of years ago, under the leadership of Governor Plenty at the time, put together a group of stakeholders to look at mercury and water. As you know, Minnesota is a land of 10,000 lakes, and mercury and water and our fish consumption is very important. And so putting that together, the group came together with a target. Target in three main areas, one being power generation, electricity, another being other industrial sources, whether it's taconite mining or other processes, kiln-fired furnaces, and the last is mercury used in products. During that time, then, an implementation plan was put together by the stakeholders and the agency, and our rulemaking now is put in to help put together and implement some of those requirements. The implementation plan and the stakeholders believed it was important for it to be put in the state regulations so that there was a level playing field for all businesses.
Follow up, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm struggling with the idea of particularly airborne type mercury from stacks and everything else. Wouldn't a regional approach be better on this? Because obviously, that happens in the Northeast. I know we've seen that with some of the air quality boards out there, California, and so on. I mean, here you have North Dakota. I mean, we could even be getting airborne mercury from Montana, for that matter. Has there been any discussions about that?
Commissioner Cadell.
Mr. Chair and others, I think I'm going to, if it's okay, pass on some of that conversation to our Assistant Commissioner David Thornton as he comes up. He has had more conversations in that regard. There are other states doing this. We do try to communicate with other states as we put together our standards, but reductions in Minnesota have direct impacts in Minnesota also, and if we are expecting others to follow our suit, we need to be a leader in that case.
Follow up, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand where we're getting reductions because of our regulations right now, but the impact of other states' essential pollution into our airs and waters, I think, is a serious matter. And when we're looking at, I mean, that's one reason there's federal standards. And if we look at a go-it-alone approach here without looking at a regional picture, we're probably not doing the job. So I'm concerned about that, and I hope that we are looking with our other neighboring states about these issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Uglum. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, I was kind of wondering when I was hearing a little talk before about standards are set by the federal government or standards set by the state government, one of the questions I have along those lines is would be an example of like on some water contamination in the East Metro on flame retardants that came from a certain product. Was that driven by more of a state standard or a federal standard when that was initially being addressed?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure what specific pollutant you're talking about.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't remember the exact name of the contaminant. I do know that it affected the cities of Lake Elmo and coming down through Woodbury, et cetera, where there was a groundwater contamination plume where there was a chemical that was identified and that was related to a flame retardant. And as a result, people were not able to drink that water any longer. They had to take remediation. So I was wondering where those standards came from. Was it a state or a federal?
Commissioner Kardalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that was PFCs, and that is an effort that was led by the State Department of Health and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, although we had conversations with EPA. I'm just going to check with folks. The EPA did not set specific standards. It was a state-led effort.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the standards were originally set by the state. Was there a reason the feds didn't have a standard on it? Was it something they didn't feel was important, or how did some of these things come about?
Commissioner Kardalka, if you're going to need to call a friend on this one, your boss is actually extremely well-versed in this specific subject because he was at Department of Health when it was on the forefront. But I know you've got some friends in the audience that can help you. Commissioner Kardalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am going to ask for a little bit of help. If I can ask a colleague to come up, Shannon Lothammer, on the issue. I'll just talk in general. Water quality standards, the federals usually don't set a specific standard, rather criteria and other information for us to use in creating our own. But I will leave up the finer details of the science to our division director.
Welcome, Ms. Lothammer. If you could identify yourself and your title for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And it's in the Outcomes Division that water quality standards are established, and we also do our water monitoring and our air monitoring as well. I just want to add to my colleague's comments about the PFCs issue in the East Metro. And just to add to what Commissioner Kardalka was saying, when it comes to water quality standards in particular, the way that the system is set up at the federal level is that the federal government, through EPA, both establishes criterion for the states to consider and then also establishes guidelines for how to develop water quality standards. And in the past, EPA did a lot more of establishing the criteria for toxic pollutants, things like that. In recent years, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, at the federal level, the focus has been more on doing studies to gather the health-based information and the environmental-based information about the effects of contaminants, and then also developing guidance for the states to consider, but not actually developing numbers for the states to consider. So in the case of PFCs, we followed, and the State Health Department followed, established guidelines about how human health-based standards are developed. But because PFCs, when they were first identified in the East Metro, was really seen as more of a localized issue, this wasn't something that was seen nationally or nationwide as a particular issue of concern. It was really up to Minnesota to take the action to develop the standards to protect human health. That's a model that other states have looked at now, as PFCs have been found to be an issue in other parts of the U.S., but it's really up to Minnesota to take the lead to protect our citizens, and that's what the Department of Health did in developing that human health-based standard.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know which of our testifiers would be best able to answer this. This kind of opens up a whole area that I have concerns on. Is it seems there's, as our society has moved forward, we've got new chemicals that keep on coming up all over the place, and some of them are having impact. Some of them we have no idea whether they have impacts on human health. And it seems many of them are finding paths into our water streams and venturing into our domestic water supply. How do you folks get your hands around that? As these new chemicals come out, who determines if they're a problem to human health and what isn't, and then how do we monitor that going forward?
Ms. Lothammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There are a couple of ways that we work on that. The Pollution Control Agency works very closely with the Department of Health in this particular area. We refer to this as contaminants of emerging concern and new concern. First of all, when there are methods available to monitor for these contaminants, we start to collect that data. The Clean Water Legacy Act and the Clean Water Fund have been very helpful to both agencies to provide resources to do that initial surveillance. And then both the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency have efforts under the Clean Water Fund that involve developing screening level information about these contaminants to see if the numbers or the concentrations that we're seeing in the environment are getting close to any levels of potential concern from a human health or from an ecological standpoint. if that was the case, then we would need to follow up to see if additional standards are needed, if there's pollution prevention actions that we can take, or what we can do in order to reduce the occurrence of those contaminants in the environment.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, appreciate it. Moving back to the PFCs, I know that once they're in the water, what's the best way to treat it? Is this something that breaks down naturally? Is it something that can be made harmless again? How do you deal with that issue? I know that right now they're pumping a lot of water out of the ground to address it right now.
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, I know I'm not an expert on treatment technology. I do know that there are some treatments that are available, things like using activated carbon to filter out those contaminants, but I can't give you a sense for the range. We could certainly follow up on that.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. Continue, Commissioner Kordelka. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Purcell. I missed you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up on the line that Representative Fisher, and this is a comment and a question, of the approximately 80,000 chemicals in commerce today, we know something about 2,000, toxicity information, about 2,000 of them or so, or 3,000? Is that approximate?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I would have to look up that information. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. There's certainly a subset of chemicals that we have information about, but that subset is growing.
Thank you.
Follow up. Okay, thank you. Continue, Commissioner Kordelka or Mr. Mueller. I can't remember where we were. Sorry. Can I just, as long as we're here, members, I want to encourage you, if you have questions with the agencies, it was our plan to make it through today, but if there's good questions and concerns, we will have the flexibility to continue. It's our hope to get through, but if there's good questions, I don't want to, this is important for folks to understand these agencies. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, on your staffing and overtime slide, there's obviously been an increase there. I seem to remember also on the last budget that was passed, provisions for more employees. How many additional employees have you hired in the last couple of years?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members,
Mr. Mueller, as you get ready there, if you could put it in the context, in all the state government, it seems like there's a number of folks that are having retirement. So where the net went up, I think Representative Fabian's question is how many was that also got replaced for all those that reached retirement? Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, we are, just like every other agency, experiencing a number of retirements as those positions become vacant. For the most part, they are filled, but certainly following an assessment of if that represents an opportunity to move in a little bit different direction. You'll see that the numbers of FTE numbers are actual paid hours for every year on that graphic through fiscal year 2014. So actual paid hours would include. Would include overtime, which for us is not a significant number of hours. It also includes our seasonal and student workers are counted and included as those paid hours as well. When you get to fiscal year 15, you see since we are partially through the fiscal year. That number is also a budgeted number, which tends to be on the a little bit on the higher side. We won't know what the actual paid number of hours is until the fiscal year is done in midsummer. Mr. Chair and members, thinking back to
Mr. Mueller, I'm sorry, I thought you were still on Representative Fabian. We have Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of following up on this retirements wave, does the agency have an estimate of, let's say, in the next 4 years, of what they can anticipate with retirements and I think other agencies probably, if they have a similar thing, because if we have 20 and 30 and 40 years of experience walking out the door, how does the agency deal with that? Maybe just a little bit on that type of transition.
Mr. Mueller or Commissioner Kadalka? Mr. Chair and members, certainly we are observing, but we can only anticipate to a point the number of retirements that occur. Certainly this is dependent on individuals officially declaring their intention to leave the agency under retirement. That being said, we do have an active effort going on in our agency, as do most other state agencies, in terms of the workforce planning, having identified not just individuals who fall in a particular demographic, but also key positions within the agency where we certainly must pay particular attention to the transfer of knowledge and experience as individuals leave the agency and others step in.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, with the changing of the workforce and understanding there are labor contracts, does the agency have any tools, like if someone was approaching retirement, to go to kind of a part-time or stepped retirement with mentoring with new employees? For example, if somebody was coming into the workforce, maybe had small kids, is there a way where I just, from personal experience, know people that walk out the door and all that experience walks out the door with them, and we're going to see this in all the agencies over the next few years. So is there any type of mentoring or transition, information transfer type of things that are going on as the boomers phase out of the workforce?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, the transition that you're referring to requires us as an agency and all other state agencies to be very deliberate about that transition. So to the best of our ability, we do try to anticipate retirements, when key people will be leaving, and that knowledge transfer that you're referring to. So we have, there are a number of tools that are available to us through the human resource management process. They include enabling kind of that next generation of employees to kind of shadow individuals in a position. Certainly some of the mentoring that you refer to does happen and is a very deliberate activity that goes on in our agency. And when you refer to mentoring, that includes employees at all levels of the organization. So that can be newer employees, kind of mid-level employees, as well as employees that are getting ready for that kind of transition.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit of a follow-up to Representative Fabian's questioning, probably for Assistant Commissioner Kadalka. Going back to the organizational chart for a moment, I guess haven't seen an org chart like this since the last time I looked at a Fortune 500 company. My question is, who determines all these divisions? Who determines when you need a new division or how these divisions interact and things? Is there a conscientious decision-making process that goes into all of these different divisions?
Commissioner Cadell. Mr. Chair and committee members, there is. This is now my fifth legislative session with the agency, And when I started about 4 years ago, we went under some reorganization, and it included rearranging divisions, including reducing some of the divisions and moving programs together into the various parts. That's a process that, for instance, at our last strategic senior managers retreat was a topic. Was it time for us to move various programs in other divisions or consolidate them to see where was the biggest, if there was a benefit to it? The question comes up, are we doing it just to reduce the amount of boxes on a piece of paper, or if it's going to provide that added benefit? The way that our agency is set up, we call it a matrix organization, so we do expect that various parts of the agency to work across the divisions to prevent siloing, and we have a lot of cross-agency teams to make sure that happens. So while they may not, a person may not be under the same supervisor, they are working together through a number of other tools that we have.
Follow-up, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess, you know, I look at this, and private industry, of course, is always looking at consolidations for efficiencies and things like that. I hope that not only the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, but every department at the state would look at that and model themselves after private industry. Point in case here, you know, the Environmental Analysis and Outcome Division. I'll be the first to say that, you know, I don't work for the agency, so I don't understand all the intricacies. But every one of your divisions has to have outcomes. Every one of your divisions, you know, the municipal division, the industrial division, has an outcome for a project or a program they're doing. And I would submit to you, I guess, just looking at the chart, every one of your divisions is doing environmental analysis one way or another. To me, you know, you should be looking at, and it should be a subject for the agency, we're spending taxpayers' dollars here, to see where you can gain efficiencies by folding in some of these divisions and trying to put them under another division where you can be more efficient. And I would hope that that conversation is not just every 4 or 5 years, but it's ongoing in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. What are you doing for that right now?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think you bring up a really good point. The agencies need to continue to adapt. And as an agency, we have a continuous improvement program starting in 2002 that was brought by a former commissioner that brought in Six Sigma. And since then, we've added a number of tools. And if you'll notice under our operations division, we have an entire unit set just to organizational improvements. We believe it's important for us to take and look at the processes that we operate under, and using whether it's lean, Kaizen events, or other types of continuous improvement tools to continue to improve how we do our work. So just as you mentioned, so the outcomes are there in the most efficient way possible. We really spend our time in that effort to make sure the processes that we are working on and the projects are done more efficiently. And that's where we see the biggest bang for the buck than necessarily combining two division directors together. As a result of that, we have won the Governor's Continuous Improvement Award for permitting last year. And this year, I'd like to invite everyone. Next Tuesday, we have our board meeting, and we have our annual Continuous Improvement Symposium, where we highlight a number of the continuous improvement projects. Each of our divisions will highlight our projects, whether it stems from contracting to petroleum remediation cleanup to other parts of our agency, because in continuous improvement, as you mentioned, is very important. Just like the private sector, we modeled ourselves off of many of the Fortune 500 companies in that effort.
Follow-up, Representative Uglum.
Yeah, follow-up and a conclusion. Well, it's good. You know, continuous improvement, Kaizen, and all of these are much used terms all over the industry and government, but the bottom line is more bang for the buck with probably the same people, number of people, or fewer people becoming more efficient and doing the job and therefore saving taxpayers' dollars. And we're not going to find that out during this hearing and everything else, but I would certainly hope that that is at the forefront, providing services to your customers more efficiently and your customers being the farmers and the business people of this state. So I'm sure there is room for improvement. I'm glad you're working on it, and I think that's got to be a priority. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Well, the customers are the people of the state, not the stakeholders, not the special interests. You know, if we want peer review and if we want sound science, you have to have people looking at it. The more eyes that are looking at it, the better it is. So, yes, this is a cumbersome thing, but the purpose of the agency is not to make a profit. The purpose of the agency is to protect people.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to add to that a little bit, too, because as I agree, there's room for efficiencies in every state agency. I work at a state university, and we're constantly seeking that. But I take note that I see your staff in my area as we learn about projects and regulations, whether it be with silica sand or ag-related or transportation. And I would hope that you are able to maintain that important communication with local folks in our districts as your work is being done out in the countryside.
Thank you. Continue, Commissioner Kadalka or Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair, looking at the graphic that's in front of you gives you an idea of the range of funding sources for our biennial budget. As a reminder, these numbers shown are for two fiscal years, fiscal years 14 and 15. We've touched on this a little bit in the first graphic. The fact that for us the general fund is not a significant funding source. The addition of the Clean Water Fund starting in fiscal 10 and continuing. And then we get to our two important environmental funds, the Environmental Fund, the Remediation Fund, and we'll be coming back and talking talking a little bit more about that. Federal funds, a series of directed grants fall in that category. Our special revenue, and then other, which is not a significant funding source. What falls in other is things like the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is an agreement that we have with the PFA. Looking at specifically at the Environmental Fund, taking a look at the receipts, the income stream that comes into this particular fund, you'll see that for us a very important income stream is the solid waste management tax. The next largest category is the collection of user fees, which is the water, air, land fees and permits, kind of all collected in one category. Next, the motor vehicle transfer fee. Fourth, the metro landfill abatement fee. I've itemized enforcement penalties. Just to highlight the fact that as a revenue source coming into the fund, that's kind of sits at less than 2%, and all other receipts, which is kind of a mixture of things like interest income, kind of other minor deposits to the fund. So as we look at 14 and 15. We're going to be looking at kind of a total of available resources as roughly just a little bit over $200 million. If we go to the next
question, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, appreciate that you have this information. Can we get something in context here to put this, go back to previous bienniums and see how these have grown? Would you get that to the committee, please?
Mr. Chair and members.
Make a note of that. That'd be great. Continue with your presentation.
Looking at the next graphic, how the resources are used within the fund. So you'll see under MPCA programs, a list of our major budget programs and the appropriations that are made to those programs. Over this 2-year period, totals $147 million.
That there are several other agencies that also receive direct appropriations from the Environmental Fund. That is, however, at 1%. And then you'll also see the second row from the bottom, a significant transfer that we make from the Environmental Fund to the Remediation Fund for in this biennium at $47 million, kind of leaving an ending balance in the fund. However, even of that ending balance, most of that is restricted use for things like our land or rather the loan programs, which kind of revolve through the fund, and a couple other minor restrictions on that particular money. Continuing with the Remediation Fund.
Excuse me, Mr. Miller.
Just to clarify, you know, in the information that I requested, I'd like it kind of in the same form, too, so that we have not just the total dollars, but also the breakdown by the different funds and where they come from. You've got the solid waste management taxes, the water and air fees and permits. Quite frankly, I'm interested in seeing the fees and permits and how that breaks down. I've had a number of conversations with businesses, local governments about how the price of these permits is going up and up and up and up. So,
Mr. Miller, Commissioner Kudelka, do you need more clarification on what Representative Fabian's looking for, or you got it?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we understand. We will provide that, yes.
Thank you. Go ahead with your presentation.
Looking at the Remediation Fund, this fund receives transfers from the Environmental Fund and from the Petroleum Fund. Those are two significant transfers into the fund. Fees and penalties, you'll see at $3.5 million or 5%, not a significant funding source in this particular fund, and other receipts, kind of miscellaneous receipts at 1%, for a total of $70 million over this two-year time frame. We also were working with a beginning balance, available resources of $80 million. And if you step to the next graphic, or the next table rather, you'll see that we take that $80 million, kind of how it's spent through the agency, $70 million. A larger number of other state agencies receive direct appropriations from the Remediation Fund. The transfer back to the Petrol Fund is to a certain extent a technicality. If there are resources that we receive from the Petrol Fund that were not spent in a particular fiscal year, they must by statute be sent back to the Petrol Fund, just part of ongoing business. And then you'll see that essentially when you get to the bottom line, we typically try not to carry a rolling fund balance in the Remediation Fund.
Mr. Mueller, if I can ask, where is the closed landfill fund or the closed landfill investment fund? I don't see that. Is that built into one of these, or where is that?
Mr. Chair, that fund is not represented on this particular graphics because it is at this point in time not a source of spending, so it does not come into our operating budget. It is a fund that resides in the state treasury. Spending will not, you know, again, by statute, does not occur from that fund until the start of fiscal year 2021, which would be July 1st of 2020. And at that point, you will start to see it become a part of our representation in terms of what our funding sources are.
That being said, Mr. Mueller, there is a requirement in law that a significant general fund payment be made back for when that money was taken out, and isn't there a fund payment in the neighborhood of around $12 million that's due this coming biennium? Or, I'm sorry, it's annually, it's double that.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair, in session law, the payback from the general fund to the closed landfill investment fund was divided into four payments. The first principal payment was $9.9 million, which was made last July. Coming up July 1st, which will be fiscal 16, the next payment is $12,550,000. And there will be a third payment also at $12,550,000, fourth payment at $13 million. Then the principal will be paid back.
And Mr. Mueller, you're making the point of when the principal payments are due. In the last budget forecast, the principal payment, I think, was made of, at that time, 9.9, if I'm not mistaken. But there was a significant additional payment made for the lost earnings on that investment that wasn't realized because the money had been taken for other uses in 2010. And wasn't that payment in the neighborhood of approaching $50 million? Wasn't it in the upper 48 or somewhere?
Mr. Chair, yes. Along with the first principal payment in July of this last year, the interest was calculated on the full $48 million and brought up to date as of July 1st of 2015, and that amount was approximately $51
million. And Mr. Mueller, you referred to it as interest, but it was actually the lost earnings, as if the money would have been invested with the investment fund, correct? Because it had earnings upwards of over 20% last year and significantly the year before that, and that's why the payment was so large. It wasn't just the interest compounded at a bank rate. It was actually lost investment earnings.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It was a change in market value.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. And Commissioner Kudelka, maybe if you could come back to us, I would like to know, what was this fund originally when it was formed, if I'm not mistaken, around the turn of the century, 2000, not 1900, but it was established with a goal to take care of the closed landfills, of which we have over 100, if I'm not mistaken, 130, 140, to take care of that. And what were the thoughts of how much money it was going to take to do that? I would like to know that and how that fund was established, because right now on paper that fund literally has $70 million, if I'm not mistaken, in the bank, and an obligation, as Mr. Mueller has just represented, upwards of $40 million plus. So on paper, if I'm not mistaken, it's got a $110 million bank account. And I would like to know, what was the original intent? What are the thoughts that would be used long term? It's a extremely important program, has had great success in closing and fixing some bad spots, what we used to call dumps that got fixed. So thank you, but I would like that when we do come back, that we so that we can all understand that better, because some of us have heard about that and wondered, whoa, what was that all about? So that would be good if we could get more information on that. Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I could talk about it right now a little bit if you'd like, or we can put together a document. It's up to you.
Commissioner Kudelka, I'd actually like you to do it right now if you're prepared. Thank you.
Sure. So, Chair and committee members, the Closed Landfill Investment Fund was created in 1999 for the purpose of setting aside and investing money for the post-closure care of the landfills in the Closed Landfill Program. There are 112 that are eligible under, 113 eligible under the statute. 109 of them have entered into the program. What we have been doing through bonding and the remediation fund is really getting these landfills in the proper condition so that we can move on to the long-term operation care and the contingency work on that. So those 109 are in a good spot. We're closing up on some of the last two landfills in Hopkins and Flying Cloud and the West Metro. So that's that first part, that construction to get the landfills in the way we need for the future. But there's still a lot of operation and maintenance that needs to be done, including leachate collection, which is the water that's collecting through the trash and material that's underneath the landfill, handling methane and flaring it as needed, and also contingency actions. We learn as Something may happen to the landfill. Things may need much larger construction. For instance, we are now investigating some hazardous waste located in a cell that may end up costing the estate upwards to close to $10 million to go in and correct that situation. So it's that long-term operation and contingent actions is what the Closed Landfill Investment Fund was created at. Now, initially, it was set up with four transfers from the Solid Waste Fund, which was revenues collected from the solid waste tax from individuals and businesses, and also insurance recovery payments that were made to the state at creation of the Closed Landfill Fund. So four payments of that of $5.1 million, and then continuing insurance recovery dollars to that point. The legislature always knew that the initial amount put in, whether it was those four payments of $5.1 million or the increased insurance recovery dollars, wouldn't be enough to be able to sustain the long-term care. Unfortunately, these landfills never go away. They're always there for us to handle. So we do need a long-term source of funding. So the idea was, as Mr. Mueller mentioned, the agency could not use the dollars until the year 2020 because it needed to grow through investments. At the time, there was not a specific dollar target that was assigned. However, the agency every year puts together a 30-year obligation memo. So the agency to MMB, we have an ongoing list of what needs to be done. And the most recent memo that was done this September has a 30-year obligation of $173 million. So when the Closed Landfill Fund is actually has the repayment of the payments and the lost revenue, as the chair had mentioned, it will be less than the ongoing obligations. So the goal is to operate the Closed Landfill Fund much like LCCMR and the Environmental Trust Fund, in where there is a principal and then the earnings off it are used yearly so that we can have the ongoing operation and maintenance that needed and come up with those contingency actions when something goes wrong and still allow the principal to go there. Just like the landfills, they will always be there, and there's always the possibility of something going wrong. We also need a stable funding source to be there and not just draw away on the principal and then after 20 or 30 years have no dollars there to cover the cost.
Thank you. Commissioner Kadelka, remind me the year put that was originally, was it 2020 that it was thought that they would begin to be able to use that money? It would take, if I'm not mistaken, language from the legislature at that time to actually access it. But was that the year, did you say?
Mr. Chair, you are correct.
Thank you. Questions on this? Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. you mentioned the source of what's in the landfills and our ongoing obligation, and you mentioned both industrial and individual sources. Can you give us a percentage of those sources?
Commissioner Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll need to get back to you on what type of landfills those were. I don't have those there.
Okay. Another question.
Representative Clark.
One of the, I know, methods of maintenance for at least one of the landfills in the metro region was to, in an attempt to break down some of the products that are in there that are toxic, was to create a kind of a system that would throw that would reach down into the fluid and throw it up into the air and break down the volatile organic compounds, for example. And I know that is now discontinued because one of the things that happens is you may not be just releasing volatile organic compounds, but others that are not so easily broken down but released to the atmosphere and possibly contaminating areas around there. I'm just wondering, is that method being used anywhere still, or has that been discontinued?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, to the specific your site you're talking about in the East Metro, I can find out the details on it for you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And trying to get an idea of what some of the future liabilities or costs may be, seem to remember we had that Albert Lee landfill that had to be completely dug up and moved. What was the total cost of a project like that where there was no responsible party? I think we bonded for that, if I remember correctly, Mr. Chair. It was over a few years,
Commissioner Kadelka or Mr. Mueller, if you want to just get back to us on a few different examples of some of these ones that were significant, or if you happen to know the one Representative Hansen's referring to, or the one that happened over on the East Metro that was a significant one that we bonded for also. Go ahead, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, it would probably be easier if we would come back to you with a list rather than my trying to shoot from the hip on total cost of some of these particular sites.
That would be great if you would, because I know in the last decade that was a significant concern as we worked through a past practice that we were able to correct in a positive way. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, quick question, kind of a follow-up on Representative Hansen's approach here. I understand that when you clean up some of these landfills, you just treat them right there on the spot, rendering the dangerous chemicals inert. I understand that. But when it comes to the point when you have to actually go in and dig up a landfill and you move that waste, where does it go?
Mr. Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it really is going to be case-by-case specific how we handle it. Sometimes we may be shoring up the sides and making sure we have a cap on top of it so that rainwater and others doesn't get into the trash. And sometimes it is building a new landfill, creating a new liner, and putting the material in there and capping it properly. Those are the examples that we do very... I would have to look and see if we were ever able to combine any landfills. Most of the time, they are taken care of right on site through various methods.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the previous slide just for a moment. You have on there $3.5 million in fees and penalties that are put into the remediation fund. Is that the sum total of all fees and penalties or just a portion?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, that is fees and penalties just to the remediation fund. And of that amount, penalties is a pretty small amount, probably several hundred thousand. Fees in this case may be reimbursements that we're getting from identified parties, and the MPCA is either doing the work or working with contractors and then billing the responsible parties for the cost.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, so those fees and penalties are strictly related to remediation work, is that correct?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and member, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have a discussion as we go forward about the role that penalties play in the MPCA's budget and whether it's appropriate that they go back into the MPCA's budget or if it would make more sense for that to go to the general fund. That's been a discussion we've had in the past, and I anticipate we'll have that discussion again. Representative Fabian.
Oh, you got it.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
Mr. Chair and members, the next graphic that you have in front of you is again our total budget over this two-year period displayed by the five budget programs, the manner in which we receive our appropriations. A particular note here is just understanding or having a sense of the relative size of the budget programs to each other. For example, the water program being at this point in time roughly a third of our overall budget. That does include the Clean Water Fund. So the next series of slides looks at each budget program, each of the five budget programs, and gives you an eight-year view over what the funding history has been. The first budget program being the water program, and in this slide you'll certainly what you'll see highlighted is the significance of how the general fund stepped down as we move from 2008 to the 2010 and 11 biennium, and kind of the establishment of the Clean Water Fund and the first set of appropriations from that fund in fiscal year 10.
Next, take a look at the AIR program. AIR program is funded, clearly the majority is from the Environmental Fund. And the other in blue funding source comes from federal grants, which has increased in the last two biennium just because of a couple particular grants, but otherwise is very stable. Next slide is the land program. You'll see that in the dark blue or purple color is the remediation fund is the main source for this program, with a small amount coming from the Environmental Fund. The Environmental Fund funds solid waste management and hazardous waste. Remediation fund covers, as we've said before, the closed landfill program, Superfund, petroleum, above and underground tanks, VIC, and brownfields are the various remediation programs. Next slide is the name of the program is the Environmental Assistance Cross Media, which means that we're blending work in various media. So a particular project could be addressing, multiple media. This is also the program where historically we've operated many of our assistance and outreach efforts. Again, you see the larger source of funding is the Environmental Fund. Second being federal funds, this is the program where we direct our, we have a large grant through EPA that comes into this particular budget program. So our last budget program is administrative support, and you'll see that largely, almost entirely funded through a miscellaneous special revenue fund. This largely represents our internal cost allocation plan that we run to operate and support the work of the agency.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. I do have a couple folks that have questions, but Commissioner Kadelka, just in planning here, were you going to have your different division directors do the presentations for these other ones, or what was your plan? We're thinking of Thursday is the day that you would come back, but is there any of these, if the division directors were doing them, are there any of those folks that are here today that are not available Thursday?
Mr. Okay. Chair and committee members, right after this, we'd like to touch base on AIR if we could.
Okay, and that's the next one. And so what we will do then, we're going to take two questions now, and then we'll ask Mr. Thornton to come forward, and we'll have him walk through his entire presentation and then take questions as time allows after his presentation. I'm assuming it's less than a half an hour long. Yes, okay. Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, appreciate your slides on the budget, but I'd like to go back to basically your first slide on the budget, FY14 and 15, the approved budget by fund. At the top there's $388.4 million. In that pie chart, it says 3% is from the general fund, and then there's the clean water, the environmental fund, and so forth. How does the clean water fund get $56.9 million? And how does the environmental fund get, what's the source of revenue for these different funds?
Mr. Mueller, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be a bad idea for you to give us that breakdown on every fund and have that for us on Thursday. Or Representative Fabian, do you want him to answer those two specific funds? I think that would be good if we see. You think that would be good if we see where the revenue stream is for those funds? That would be good if that works, Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we can answer this really quickly here.
Go ahead. I like it when you say that, so thank you. Go ahead and answer for those funds. Commissioner Kadelka.
Clean Water Fund is the dedicated sales tax, the 0.375%, and so that is the entire revenue source for the Clean Water Fund. The Environmental Fund is this slide number 9, which has all the funding sources for the Environmental Fund that goes in there. And then slide number 11 has all the funding sources for the remediation fund of all the dollars going in. So that's the information we would provide.
And
is there additional information, and in what categories we can make sure we get that for you?
I'll allow Representative Fabian to answer that question, but Commissioner Kudelka, just to go back, the Clean Water Fund, you noted $56 million. That's the MPCA's share of the approximately $100 million, which is one-third of the three-eighths of 1%. So it's approximately a little more than 50% of the one-eighth that's dedicated to clean water. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, yes, I understand those are the slides, but I guess I'd like more detail within each of those slides to see where the dollars actually come from. You know, does it come from
somebody? Thank you, Representative Fabian. They'll get back to us on that with additional information. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along Representative Fabian's question, and if we get that information, where they come from and how they're distributed, I was looking at the graph, the budget trends MPCA lands and the budget trends MPCA Environmental Assistance Trust Media, and trying to reconcile and maybe it'll help me to reconcile how the money is then distributed, because there's a table that you had up there that said there was a transfer from Environmental Fund and I think to remediation, and that kind of information would, as much as you can give specificity on that when you come back, would be very helpful.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Commissioner Kudelka, our able staff, Mr. Hagemeyer, reminded me that the $56 million was a biennium number, and the Clean Water Fund is actually about $200 million per biennium, so it's a little over 25%, not 50%, as I stated. That's why we should be careful to not say things and just listen to the people around us. I think we're ready for Mr. Thornton, who will have walked through air quality. Are there any other division directors that aren't available on Thursday, Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair, we'll be able to go on Thursday with the rest.
Okay.
Just real quick, while Assistant Commissioner David Thornton's coming up, we have in front of you your dashboard. We talk about a lot about the metrics we use. These are just several of the hundreds that we use to make sure that our performance measures, we are on the right path. We do each spring a strategic measures review by senior managers to make sure we're getting the environmental outcomes that we have. And then each fall, we also have a review of our operational metrics to make sure things like timeliness, how contracts are done, that the senior leadership helps make sure they understand what's going on. And these are the metrics that we rely on and are feed into our continuous improvement process that I talked about earlier. So I will pass over that piece and turn it over to Assistant Commissioner David Thornton.
Thank you, Commissioner. And members, some of you may want to keep, we don't get a lot of nice colorful brochures because I don't like it when they print a lot of these. This is a good one, and when we get into the MPCA's budget later this session, you may find this one helpful. So if you want, feel free to put it in your small save file. Assistant Commissioner Thornton, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Pollution Control Agency for Air Policy. In a short terms, our air quality in Minnesota is better than it was and continues to improve, but it's not as good as it should be. Even at current air pollution levels that we're experiencing, we are having health impacts, and that's something that we want to try to address. The major air quality challenges that we face, I'm going to mention right now, and then I'm going to show you a few slides that'll describe them a little better. We need to address new federal air quality standards that EPA is going to be promulgating over the next few months. In order to help do that, we need to develop some programs, generally non-regulatory in nature, to address some of the more significant sources of air pollution, which are the what I call the you and me sources, things like our car, our lawn equipment, our houses and buildings. We need to continue to reduce health risks from key pollutants, particularly in communities with higher exposures, and we're going to need to develop our state plan to implement EPA's Clean Power Plan that's going to impact emissions from utilities. this graph that we're looking at right now shows you how we've made some steady and dramatic progress in reducing emissions and improving air quality. The line at the bottom of the chart is cumulative air pollution emissions, and you can see how dramatically they've gone down, especially in comparison to some of the other lines on this chart. The top one, which is the real gross state product, the next one down, vehicle miles traveled, the next one, population, followed by energy consumption, and then to stimulate conversation, you can see greenhouse gases. We've not made so much progress there. Okay. Looking at actual ambient air quality relative to standards, which is this red dotted line on this graph, we're trying to answer, is our air healthy to breathe? And for the most part, we meet air quality standards. We had a period of time a few years ago where we actually exceeded the fine particulate standard. Fine particulate is a problem typically in the wintertime when we have warmer winter conditions and air pollution builds up in what we call a temperature inversion. We didn't have that last winter. We had a lot of cold air blowing through, and air pollution was pretty low last winter. But fine particulate matter remains a problem for us, and if we have a couple of not-so-cold winters in a row, we might be find ourselves exceeding the standard. The other pollutants, we meet the standards, and the one that we're currently the most concerned about is ozone. This graph shows ozone levels at our various monitors around the state. The red dotted line at the top is the current federal standard. EPA is in the process of revising that number to reflect more recent health studies relative to ozone. And the shaded blue box at the top is the range of numbers that they're considering changing that standard too. And if you assume that they'll probably pick something around the middle of that range, then it looks like we'll become what EPA refers to as a non-attainment area, meaning that we'll be out of compliance with the federal ozone standards. This is a problem because it's going to increase red tape and work needed to issue permits here. It will require potential regulations for sources that are not currently regulated, such as small businesses. And it's estimated by the Minnesota Chamber that it would cost up to $200 million a year in additional pollution controls and regulations and red tape. So this is something that we want to avoid at all costs. EPA will be announcing their decision on the standard later this year in September or October. These four charts or these four maps on this slide do a very good job of depicting what's really contributing to our air quality problems. In this case, we're looking at inhalation cancer risk of all pollutants, but the picture is very similar depending on for any pollutant. Up in the light graph or map that says point or permitted facilities, this is the impact, the health impact of the emissions from large factories and large emission sources that we regulate at the Pollution Control Agency. And as you can see, the health risk due to these facilities is fairly small and confined to the immediate vicinity of those facilities. The other three maps show what I call the you and me sources, or what we've been referring to internally as non-point air pollution sources. These are smaller businesses, things that are typically not regulated by the PCA, wood-burning stoves, dry cleaners, gas stations, and on-road and non-road mobile sources such as cars, trucks, construction equipment, ATVs. And as you can see from this graph, most of the health risk and much of our emissions are due to those sources that we don't directly regulate. And that gets back to one of the challenges that I said. We need to develop ways to try to encourage reductions from these sources in a non-regulatory manner. This is my final slide. I have a pie chart there that shows you the breakdown of sources of emissions in Minnesota. And again, as you can see, point sources or the factories in blue are only about a quarter of the problem. This is the area that we've made the most progress in. This is where we've really driven emissions down. Our industries have been leaders in reducing emissions, in particular the utility industry. And this is not really a fruitful area for us to pursue much further. It's these other pieces of the pie, generally things that we don't regulate directly, where we need to try to achieve additional reductions. We need to do this in order to make sure that we try to meet the federal air quality standards. We are working with a number of partners in an effort called Clean Air Minnesota, which is a public and private partnership involving government, business, and advocates to identify and encourage ways to reduce emissions at non-regulated sources in a voluntary way. This group has been working for a number of years. They've been very successful. You may have heard of Project Green Fleet, which was an effort to reduce diesel emissions with some incentives to help offset some of the costs to retrofit vehicles. And that program so far has resulted in a reduction in emissions equivalent to taking 750,000 cars off the road. And so we want to continue to make some efforts like that to try to help us stay below the new federal ozone standards. I haven't really talked about it yet, but EPA's Clean Power Plan will be looming in the not too distant future. This is a regulation that EPA is going to be developing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. It will require each state to develop their own specific plan on how to reach targets. EPA will be finalizing this regulation later this summer, and we will have a year or so to develop our own response to it. We are already beginning by getting folks together to start talking about what the approach we should take here in Minnesota should be, and this is going to be a fairly heavy lift over the next 12 to 18 months.
Thank you, Commissioner Thornton. Can you remind us, just one kind of general question, our power generating mix in Minnesota, how does it differ somewhat from the national average, per se? If you break it down into the couple different categories of power plants, what's ours compared to the nation?
I'm going to do this from memory, and I can get you some real numbers later when we come back in on Thursday. We have more nuclear power than the national average. We have more renewable energy than the national average, mostly wind, but a little bit of hydro. We have a little bit more coal than the national average, but that's going down, and we have less natural gas power generation than the national average, and that's going up.
And Commissioner Thornton, do you divide the coal into newer or older technology coal, or are you just kind of lumping that? Are our coal plants, in the average of coal plants, where do they fit in?
Mr. Chairman, our coal plants are cleaner than the national average. The ones that were less clean have been cleaned up through a number of efforts by mostly Minnesota Power and Xcel Energy, and or they are they have been retired or they're scheduled to be retired.
Okay. Thank you. We have a number of questions here. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thornton, just a couple of questions. One relates to, I'm glad you brought up this issue of non-attainment. I mean, it's been around for a while. I remember, might have even been my freshman year, there was an op-ed in the Star Tribune written, I think, by the Chamber of Commerce of all interests, and, you know, warning about this issue of the federal penalties. And so you'd mentioned one strategy was, you know, reducing vehicle miles traveled or cars, and you know, why haven't we been able to, you know, make a dent on this over the, you know, at least 10 years that this has been kind of an issue before us, this question of non-attainment?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, it's really because we're trying to approach this in a non-regulatory way. It's emissions that come from all of us collectively, the activities that we engage in on a daily basis, heating our homes, having a recreational fire in the backyard, driving to and from work and other things, mowing our yards, the small businesses in our communities, and it's just the sheer number of sources and the difficulty in encouraging people to change what they're doing. The success that we've had with Project Green Fleet and diesel retrofits has been because there was a little bit of money involved in it, and we were able to provide some financial incentives to people. We didn't pay for it all. We paid for a small portion of it, but it was enough to encourage people to act. And so we're struggling with getting people to act on reducing their own emissions.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair, and you know, maybe as we move forward during the session, I think it would be helpful to get your sense or the agency's sense of any things that the legislature can do on this question. And then, Mr. Chair, my second question relates to I appreciate I mentioned this to Commissioner Landwehr when he was here last week, and I want to let you know that I appreciate your inclusion of issues around greenhouse gas emissions and climate change and your presentation. And it sounds like we're inching towards the goal of the legislative goal of 15% by I think it's 2015, but you know, I think that jumps up to 50% by 2030, and I think we're definitely going to be challenged with that, and it's a very urgent question. And so what strategies does the agency envision to really get up to that 50% reduction by 2030? And I know Mr. Thornton, you were very involved in that first climate change advisory group report that came out at Governor Pawlenty and the legislature's request, I think, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. Do we need to update that? Are we, you know, have things shifted enough that we need to really, you know, dust that off and get serious about this new goal that we have to reach by 2030? It's becoming even more urgent with some of the latest scientific you know, studies that have come out. So what are your thoughts about how we move forward on that?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we are not on target to meet any of the legislature's goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We're going to fall short of the 2015 goal, and we're going to fall far short, at least on the path we're currently heading down, for the 2025 goal. The Climate Change Advisory Group in 2008 came out with a number of suggestions for things that could be done to reduce emissions. Very few of them were implemented. A couple that everybody went all in on, renewable energy and energy efficiency, we're doing really well on. But most of the others have not been implemented. EQB is taking a fresh look at all of that, along with the help of the Department of Commerce and the Pollution Control Agency, and that's underway right now. We're looking at a few key policies, and we're not looking at all of them. We're freshening up the analysis and renewing some of the assumptions based on, you know, the best available current information. And later this year, we'll have the results of that, including the potential job growth that might be associated with some of those strategies. So that's something that you'll see later this winter, early spring.
Well,
thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you for that, Mr. Thornton. And I think that should be a challenge for us, because I think it's very problematic if we're not going to be hitting these targets, and we need to be making more progress and faster. And as I mentioned to you with the non-attainment, which is also a crisis, I would argue, you know, any direction that the legislature can be taking would be useful. You mentioned that the suggestions in the CCAG report were not implemented. Maybe we need more than just suggestions to move forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have
5 more questions and 10 minutes, so we're going to have about 2 minutes total. So if you can keep your answers short and the questions short. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Thornton. The graph that you or the slide that you have on the metro-wide inhalation cancer risk all pollutants, in the lower left-hand corner, you have, first of all, my question is are these actual measurements, or is this the result of modeling?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is modeling.
Representative Fabian.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got just what
Representative Fabian, follow up.
Real quickly, you know, the slide that's in the lower left-hand corner talks about boats, trains, farm equipment, and ATVs. Chair McNamara, you live here. I'm not sure where you can drive an ATV in Minneapolis or St. Paul, and I certainly don't know of any farm equipment. So I'd like further explanation on your modeling and so forth as we move forward. I had some questions about some modeling slides that were presented in the last legislative session regarding air quality in northwest Minnesota. I think some of the issues with regards to modeling versus actual measurements leave some real holes in some of the data that's being presented.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we can do that. To be more inclusive for that chart or the map in the lower left, if it should also include construction equipment, which is probably a good portion of a lot of the stuff in the central city area and around some of those areas. But we can get that information to you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a more positive note, to what do you attribute the significant reduction in aggregate emissions?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, large factories and utilities have reduced their emissions dramatically over the last 20 or so years. That's the bulk of it. Also, part of it is the federal motor vehicle control program that is reducing tailpipe emissions and improving fuel efficiency in transportation sources, both on and off-road engines.
Follow-up. Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, what large industry and utilities, what was the, why did they, what do you attribute their reductions?
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, largely the need to meet air quality standards and other kinds of standards that EPA has developed. Some of that has been done through voluntary action ahead of when it was would have been required, but most of it was to improve air quality and meet air quality standards.
Okay, thank you. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you talked a little bit about the new federal standards that may be promulgated for ground level ozone and the cost of business. Could you briefly touch on that number again, the cost of business, and then also the cost that you're anticipating that the agency is going to have to bear to put these new regulations into effect? And then is there any talk about how long business will have to comply with the new federal standards?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, first of all, we've not estimated what our costs might be to implement these new standards. That's a great question, though. The cost that the chamber came up with was based on the experience in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which has been out of compliance with the ozone standards for a number of times and have implemented a number of regulations that we haven't had to have here in the Twin Cities. So that number that I mentioned was based on Milwaukee's experience scaled up to the size of the Twin Cities, and it was on the order of I think it was $160 to $240 million a year in potential additional costs to regulate to meet these regulations. And I'm sorry, what
time,
was your third?
Time to comply.
Time for compliance, correct. Typically, when EPA proposes a standard, we have 3 years, 2 or 3 years to put a plan together, and we have to demonstrate reasonable progress Ozone is a fairly difficult pollutant because some of it is transported in from other states, and typically EPA has allowed additional time for compliance, and in some cases in California they've never been able to comply with the standards, so it just keeps you get into a do loop.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned on the major air quality challenges the issue of reducing health risks from key pollutants, especially in communities with higher exposures, and I'm sure many of us represent some of those communities. I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that, and I was just thinking of what Representative Ugin was talking about. You know, we're talking about the cost to businesses, but the cost to human health, those human health costs, is that some of what you're talking about there? And I think, you know, I'd like to see that throughout whenever we're talking about cost, not just cost to business, but also the human health cost, since that's a very direct result of some of the air pollution in particular.
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we did some work last year on the human health cost of air pollution, and we can bring that back to you if you'd like and hand it out on Thursday. And in terms of trying to reduce risks in overexposed communities, one of the strategies that we're pursuing is targeting pollution emission reduction activities in those communities. So, for example, I'll go back to the diesel retrofit program. We have diesel retrofit money to spend throughout the state. It does matter a little bit where it is spent, and so if we can, we're trying to target engines and trucks and equipment that is operating in some of the more densely populated and lower-income communities, as an example of what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative
Clark. Just a quick request, I guess, for some maybe mapping in that regard, because one of the things we know that you mentioned lower-income communities, those also happen to be mostly communities of color, and the disproportionate impact of this type of pollution on those kind of communities comes under the title of environmental justice or environmental injustice, and I'm wondering if you would just maybe give us some more mapping or description of that. There was recently an article not too long ago, Mr. Chairman, about the impact of traffic pollution on learning disabilities and behaviors and so on, and those are costs that I hope we can also look at and see.
Thank you, Representative Clark, and we'll look forward to that additional information on Thursday. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Thornton, in relation to the ozone situation with the federal government, has this Minnesota PCA had any input to EPA as to what the level should be set at?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I don't believe we commented to EPA on the standard.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, do we have an opinion?
Commissioner Thornton.
We would have to yield to the health department about what the appropriate level, health level is for that standard. We definitely will have opinions on how it's implemented and what we need to do in order to try to meet it if it does change, but we would need to rely on the health department on the actual health effects.
Follow up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it seems to me that this is a very important issue and has an effect on Minnesota, on not only on the citizens of Minnesota, but on your agency. The cost estimates are very high. I would think that, and I know EPA is struggling to try and decide what the number should be, and it seems to me that we and the citizens of Minnesota are not being well represented.
If you could follow up, Commissioner Kudelka, when you come up back on Thursday, where that is with the Department of Health and weighing in on that issue, that would be great. Well, thank you. Members, on tomorrow we will have an overview of the Minnesota Zoo. I anticipate that overview will include discussion of hold on, everybody, we got a couple seconds yet. It will include discussion about the deficiency bill. Then we'll have an overview of Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage and LCCMR. With that, members, we're adjourned.